Going Linux, episode 166, Computer America, number 47. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom. Whether you're new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in Going Linux.
We hope that you'll find this and all of our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
In today's episode, Computer America.
Computer America.
Hello and welcome into the Computer America show. It's the nation's longest running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. It's Tuesday, the 21st of February, 2012. And I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
And I'm your co-host, Ben.
And how you doing, Ben?
Good.
All right. So it is the third Tuesday of the month, and our show is all about Linux. And we continue to debate the topic, is Linux right for you? It's an important operating system, so we devote the entire show on the third Tuesday of the month to the subject of Linux in order to answer your questions. And if you have a Linux question, tonight's the night for you to give us a call or get in touch with us. Joining us is our Linux expert, Larry Bushy. Larry is the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast. Larry, welcome into Computer America. How are you?
Well, I'm feeling really great. I got my confirmation email for the buddy list winners. So
you did.
For the newsletter. That's what I'm Excellent. Trying to say. So I'm doing great.
All right. So we're, of course, now when Larry appears on the show, all about Linux, I always ask Larry to give us an underlying topic, you know, what we're going to be talking about. And tonight's show, the underlying topic is going to be about podcasting. And specifically, the topic is listening to podcasts using something called G-Podder. And G is spelled with a lowercase g and then a capital P and then lowercase O-D-D-E-R, G-Podder. Okay, so we're going to talking about podcasting, listening to podcasts. Now, this is just – we're going to be talking about listening to podcasts, not actually doing a podcast, correct?
Right, exactly, yes.
Okay. With something called G-Podder. So what is G-Podder?
Well, G-Podder is something that's very, very popular among the Linux community for listening to podcasts because it is a – it's a nice little tool that allows you to subscribe to podcasts both on your computer screen, on the internet – and on your phone. Mm-hmm. And it works with Linux, Windows, Mac, BSD, a whole bunch of things, including MeeGo, which is the old Nokia mm-hmm. phone operating system. So it's really, really cross-platform.
Okay.
And so it's very, very popular, mm-hmm. Especially amongst the Linux folks. And it's an alternative to the podcast side of iTunes, although in Linux there are many other things that do the music side as well as the podcast side of iTunes. Mm-hmm. But the one advantage of G-Podder on Linux is you can also run it from the Linux command line.
Yeah.
So you don't even have to use the graphical user interface, which is great if you're listening to stuff and you don't want to have this big resource-hungry application like iTunes drying yeah. down all your processing power just to listen to something while you're sitting at your computer checking your email.
Is iTunes really that intensive when it comes to resources?
Well, maybe not on a Mac, but okay. certainly on Windows. I found it that okay. way when I was using it on Windows.
Fair
and
enough.
That's quite a while ago, so they may have improved things. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm speaking out of school here.
No, but, I know.
You know, it was a while ago, but it was a resource hog for me.
Because you know, things do change. I mean, when I think of Photoshop, I think of resource hog, and it still is. You know.
Yeah, you never know.
But Microsoft Word, for example, was a huge resource hog on the Mac, and then. Then later on, you know, the most recent iterations, it's very, very easy to use. You know, it runs quite nicely. But
yep.
I don't have any data on iTunes, so I'd be curious to know if it's a resource hog on Windows or if they've, made it run better. Like Safari is not a resource hog. It's fairly light. Well, listen, we're up against the break. And we're going to continue on. We're just getting started. This is the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network. Larry Bushy continues on with us both hours. It's all about Linux tonight. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Twenty-one minutes after the hour here on the Computer America Show, 866-606-TALK, the toll-free number, live at ComputerAmerica.com, our email address, or the chat room at ComputerAmerica.com. Larry Bushy continues on with us. We're just getting started in our all-Linux show, and the topic for this month is listening to podcasts using a Linux program called GPodder. And you were just getting started with it, so why don't you continue on, Larry?
Okay, well, GPodder, as I was mentioning, is very, very cross-platform, and it is very unfortunate tonight that their website for the web-based version of it is down, which is at GPodder.net.
Wouldn't you know it?
I'm getting a 500 internal server error. Inconvenient for us, yes, because I was hoping to be able to show you online some of the features that it has, but well, I'll just describe them, and that's what you get for live radio.
Yeah, that's true. Welcome to live broadcasting.
Completely unpredictable. So there is the gpodder.org site, which gives you some very teeny tiny screenshots, which unfortunately don't expand very well. As far as I can see, they just link you to other things. Like the desktop one links you to where you can download it for your desktop, so you really can't see too much. You know what? Let me just start it up here on my machine.
If you go to or just Google GPodder, they have a cache version of the webpage, and it's kind of a little thumbnail, but I can pretty much see what's on GPodder.
Okay, that's a great idea. That's probably better than starting it up, because it will start downloading podcasts in the background.
And you don't want to put any more strain or resources on while you're doing Skype and everything.
If you go to Google, they actually have a cache version of the website, so you can still go to it. You just can't go to an updated one.
By the way, I had something occurred to me, Larry, and we're talking about GPodder and listening to podcasts, but you know what we should do, and my apologies to those who are very savvy, but we probably should explain maybe some new people listening who don't know what a podcast is. There's some confusion, so maybe we should first explain what a podcast is and then talk about listening to them using GPodder. So why don't you do that?
Probably a good idea.
Yeah, just what the heck.
So. Kind of the way things go.
Yeah.
Okay, so a podcast is really a way of listening to audio and viewing video content that has been pre-recorded, but instead of going on the internet and going and finding it, you can have it delivered to you. And that's one of the things that GPodder does for you, is it's a podcast receiving software and also known as a podcatcher. And
isn't that the basic concept behind all podcasts? In other words, you can, instead of going downloading the show, you have some sort of podcasting software running on your computer. And it is the job of that podcasting software to go to the podcast to which you've subscribed to, because you have to subscribe to it, and once you do that, and then it will, without you being there, it will just go ahead and automatically, download it, and you can listen to it. Hey, we've got an incoming caller on Skype who has a question. Computer America, Craig Craftsman. Hi, who do we got on Skype with us?
My name is Charlie.
Hey, Charlie. Hi, welcome to the show.
Charlie. Yeah, I try to get you back on your other phone, that 866, and the phone keeps ringing.
866-606-8255, and the phone keeps ringing?
Yeah, there's no answer. I tried at 866-606-8255. I tried it about three times, and just keeps ringing. But I got you last week, and we were disconnected, but I was able to get you on this 825. 8 number.
I typed to our board op, and he says that he's there. You want to try calling and stay on Skype with us, and why don't you try calling, and then if you get through, I'll disconnect you from Skype. How about that? You want to try that?
Okay, I'll try.
Okay, well, go ahead. Stay on Skype. Are you nearby the phone now?
Or maybe should we just stay on Skype?
Well, we could, but he said he did not hear the phone, and he says that he's there, so something is very strange.
I'm going to have to disconnect.
Then stay with Skype. Go ahead and ask your question, Charlie.
Okay. Well, actually, I want to finish up with Larry on this. We talked last month about updating my Mint I got version 8, and I want to update it to version 12. And he was talking.
Yes, I remember.
Okay. Well, these are two ways that I figured to do it. You let me know if there's a better way. There's a couple magazines, one called Linux Pro Magazine and the other one called Linux Users, where you can buy the magazine and they got a Linux Mint DVD right in there.
Okay.
And one of them has Linux 12, the other one has four Mint 12, and the other one has four Linux programs, one Fedora 16, Linux Mint 12 RC, and Puppy Linux. Now, I was wondering, I was going to either purchase that or download Mint on a blank disk and then install it on my computer. But I got two internal hard drives, one running Windows 7, the other one running Linux Ubuntu, which I'm having no problems at all with,
right.
But I would like to install it on Windows, on Linux Mint to update it, but I want to make sure it goes on Mint and not on goes over Ubuntu or goes on my other one. Or do you have a better way, Larry?
Okay, so let me understand this. You have two hard drives, one with Windows on it, and the other one right. has Ubuntu and Linux Mint on separate partitions?
Right, right.
Okay.
Now, when I boot up on my computer, it boots up on default on Windows.
Yeah.
But if I want to go into the menu, boot menu, I have a choice of going into my secondary drive, and then when I go into that, it says, I want to go into Ubuntu or into Mint. And
right.
so I just enter either one, and I get in there very good. So
yeah.
What is the best?
Well, as far as which way to get Linux Mint, whether it's one of the DVDs that you get with the magazines or whether you download and burn it yourself onto a CD or a DVD, either way will work fine. If you're in a hurry, you can burn it. Or if you're going to buy the magazine anyway, go ahead and get the one with the DVD in it, and that'll save you a little bit of trouble. And then what happens is when you put the DVD in, to the DVD drive, you turn off your computer and reboot. Then there will be a key that you will need to press. Depending on your computer, it'll either be the delete key, the F12 key, the F9 key, or the escape key or something that will then offer to allow you to boot from the CD. So
okay.
once you've booted from the CD, it will be running Linux Mint. And it will be running from the DVD drive. And since I'm hearing the music, maybe I can finish this description of how you would install it after the break.
All right, Charles, I'll tell you what we're going to do, too. During the break, I'm going to hang up with you. You call the 866-606 number, and then we'll take you on the phone. Okay, Charles?
Okay.
All right.
Very good.
Welcome back to the Computer America Show. And being the omnipotent co-host that I am, I have no idea what's going on with our caller.
We have the caller. His name is Charlie. He's listening to us in Park Ridge, Illinois. And do you want to bring him back on now, Pat?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so Charlie, welcome back to the Computer America Show. You with us?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. Okay. See,
sounding good.
Yeah, it is. Sounding good. Okay. So let's continue on with your. You want to recap the problem and then pick it up for Larry?
Sure. Yeah. So, Charlie, you were asking what's the best way to get Linux Mint 12 installed over your Linux Mint existing installation.
Right.
So once you have the DVD and once you've booted to the DVD, you'll see an icon on the screen that says install or install Linux Mint, one of the two. And you just go ahead and click that. It will begin the installer. Now, as you run through the installer, it will offer to install it alongside of your existing distributions, which means that you could have it actually installed alongside Windows, Ubuntu, and your existing Mint, so you could actually have two different versions of Mint. But you said that you want to remove the current version and replace it or upgrade it with the Mint 12.
Yeah,
that point is one of the options will be to replace your existing Linux Mint partition and replace it with Mint 12. You select that, and then it will just run you through the rest. You'll put in your username, your password, your country, and time zone, and just let it install from there. And it will not overwrite your Windows partition. It will not interfere with your Ubuntu partition. And once it's finished installing, it'll ask you, do you want to reboot now? And if you do, then you have your choice of booting into Windows or Ubuntu or Linux Mint 12.
Oh, that sounds great. That sounds great. Now, is it possible, you mentioned it about time. Mm-hmm. I am having one little problem with the clock.
Okay.
When I go from my Windows to either Linux versions, it's off 6 hours.
Yep.
It's off 6 hours early or late. Now,
yeah.
with that, it will correct itself, both on Ubuntu and Mint. It corrects itself within less than a minute. But when I go in from Linux to Windows, it's off 6 hours the other way, and it does not correct itself. I got to go to the clock, and I got to change it manually.
In Windows, yeah. You have to change the Windows and the clock that's in Windows is what you're saying?
Yes, I have to change it manually every time I go from either Linux, one of the Linux versions, yeah, into Windows. It's off 6 hours early or 6 hours late, and I got to change it manually.
And how do you have the clock configured in Windows? Do you have it automatically to update from the internet, or do you have the proper time zone in Windows? In the clock?
I don't know about the. I know I got the top a proper time zone. It's Central Time. The other part, I'm not too sure of.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I think you're on the right track, Craig.
Yeah, I think that's
Linux,
what's happening. Yeah.
Yeah, Linux automatically. Unless you set it differently, it automatically synchronizes its time with the internet, whereas Windows, you have to, in some cases, depending on your version of Windows, you have to download some software to make it do that. In some cases, it's depending on your version of Windows, it may already be installed there, and it's just a setting. But it's possible that what's causing this is that the time in your computer's BIOS is off by 6 hours from your time zone. So one way to permanently fix this would be to go into BIOS and change the time. But that's not something that I want to try to walk you through on the radio. So the best bet would be, and I'm not really good at diagnosing Windows issues, but if you can find a way to in your Windows clock setup.
The control panel, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, in the control panel.
There's a checkbox.
Find a way to have it set so that the clock is synchronized with the internet. That should fix your problem.
There's a checkbox there that says synchronize with the internet. And that you.
I got Windows 7 on there. And like I say, when I go from Windows to Linux, off 6 hours, but it does correct itself.
Yeah.
But when I do first, it does not.
But I'm saying that if
you just inadvertently asked one of the questions that I've been having for a long time, is I have the exact same problem. I'm not running Linux at all, but I got mine from my computer from the West Coast. So my every time I reboot my computer, it's 3 hours late.
Yeah.
And I think what Larry said about it's in the BIOS and everything, there's actually a small internal clock inside the computer that you can actually change to set it to your correct time zone. And that's the problem that at least I think I'm having.
Yeah. And the other thing for you to look at, Charlie, is to look at the clock control panel. You can right click on the clock if it's in your system tray. And then you should be able to click on that, and then there is a checkbox that says synchronize time with the internet or something along those lines, and probably that's not checked. You need to check that off and make sure that the correct time zone is set. And I believe when you come back, if that checkbox is activated, it will automatically resync it to the proper time.
Very good. Well, I really thank you guys very much, and I'll play this back because what I do is. I know it's podcast, so like tomorrow it'll be on. I can play it and listen to it again and go through it then.
All right,
I really appreciate all you guys, all the help. You've got a great program.
Charlie, listen, thank you so much for listening to the show, and you keep listening, okay?
Will do.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
You too.
All right. All right, so there you go. And again, if you want to call us, and hopefully we'll answer the phone this time, 866-606-TALK, 866-606-8255. We'll get you on and get you through any questions you have about Linux. And that's what we do here. That's our policy here. When Larry comes on, we're talking about a topic, and we're talking about that. But if a phone call comes in and you have a question, we're going to stop talking about what we're talking about and direct our attention to what your problem is to see if we can help you out. That's what we do here here on the Computer America Show. So anyhow, we're going to go back to our topic, which, of course, is podcasting and specifically listening to podcasts using something called GPodder. And I know you were just in the process of explaining what a podcast was, and we kind of talked about how it will automatically download the MP3 file, the archive of the podcast, without you having to be in front of your computer. That's what the software does. And so then it will either save it to the hard drive or burn it to a CD for you. It depends how you configure the software. That's totally up to you. So when you get back to your computer in the morning or whenever it is that, you know, you come back from work, those recordings will be waiting for you on your computer. You don't have to download them. It'll do it automatically. And the way podcasts work is that the service keeps track of, you know, the new podcast. Maybe there's a topic or type of, but there's a date, and so it will try to do it, you know, every day. If it's a daily podcast, every week. If it's a weekly podcast, and it's a great way to do it because then you don't have to keep track of it. You don't have to worry about it. The podcasting software does all of that for you. You see.
Exactly right, okay. And that's an excellent description. Mm-hmm. And there's also a nice video that the folks at Common Craft have put out quite a while ago, probably 5 or 6 years ago now, that is about podcasting, and it's called Podcasting in Plain English. And it's a nice little video that does a great job of explaining it. So I'll include a link in the show notes to that, and I just put it in the chat room for those people who want to look at it. But that is essentially it. It allows you to time shift your audio listening, just as Charlie was going to do with the Computer America show. And most podcasts actually have a way to subscribe to them. And
yes.
Subscribing is nothing more than telling your podcast receiving software, this is the podcast I want you to download whenever there's a new episode.
Usually there's an XML page provided with all the podcasts and the associated dates. With iTunes, they make it even easier because you can just see it right there and subscribe to it through iTunes and use iTunes to download. iTunes acts as your podcasting software in that case. You don't have to do anything. iTunes will do it for you. And take it from the if it's on the iTunes website, iTunes service. If it's not, then you have to use the podcasting software to get it. And and one of those podcasting products for Linux is called GPodder. So that I think that kind of catches us up to where we wanted to be.
Yeah, now we're back full circle.
Okay.
So GPodder, as I mentioned earlier, has a website as well that allows you to subscribe right on the website and listen to your podcast right there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you to keep track of things, but you can download a client, some software that runs on your computer and runs in the background and downloads episodes whenever they're available so that you don't have to be online to listen. It does have to be online, of course, to go get the episodes. But you can set that up to download. And there's a version for phones as well, so you can set it up for your phone, too.
Very nice. You know, if I were to name this Potter software, I would call it Harry Potter. All right, this is the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network. It's all about Linux. Specifically, we're talking about podcasting and listening to podcasts using G. Potter. We will continue on. Stay with us. Fifty-one minutes after the hour here on the Computer America Show. It's all about Linux, and Larry Bushy is here with us. You know, all the screwy names they give Linux software, you know. you think, you know, if the guy would have a sense of humor, if he was going to call it Potter, he just, P-O-D-D-E-R, he should call it Harry Potter, you know, and that would have been it. You know, I think that would be a great name. Or, you know, if you're listening, if you're coming up with, if someone's writing another listening a podcast product, you know, call it Harry Potter. You know?
There you go.
That's it.
Absolutely.
And it wouldn't be a copyright infringement because you're not spelling it. It's P-O-D-D-E-R, not P-O-T-T-E-R. So.
Oh, and I think G. Potter actually just came back online.
Oh, nice. There you go.
Okay.
All right.
Stuff. They were listening to the show, and they fixed it. That's what it was.
That's what it was.
So, anyway, one of the things that I wanted to mention is that if you want to use GPotter, you can actually download it, install it, or go online, and you can see an entire directory of podcasts right in GPotter itself. So,
that's nice.
you can go through their podcast directory and find, do a search for topics of interest. So, if you're interested in Linux, there are dozens and dozens of Linux podcasts out there, and there are all kinds of tech podcasts. I'm sure there's a knitting podcast out there if you're
knitting. Such a,
yeah, I'm sure.
Okay.
Yeah, and right. Box Turtle podcast. I'm sure they're all out there somewhere. But you can get all the popular ones like This American Life and even
that sounds like an insurance podcast.
You know. I think that's one of the NPR things. Yeah.
Not going to get the low. They also even forgot to mention and get the Going Linux podcast there, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I thought that went without mentioning, but thanks for mentioning it.
Sure.
Of course, we're listed on there. That's where I first found our podcast. No. one other thing I wanted to let you know about is that one of the things I found out recently about GPotter is that. Instead of having to connect your listening device, your iPod or your Android phone or whatever it is you listen to your podcasts on, if you're not listening to them on your computer, rather than have to connect it by a USB cable or some other wired device. I listen on my Android phone. There is a way to wirelessly, provided your listening device has wireless capability, wirelessly synchronize with GPotter on an Android phone. It's something called BotSync, BotSync, and it's an Android application. I was going to say App Store, but that's trademarked, so I can't say that. The Android Marketplace, that's what it is. It's available on there. And what that little piece of software does is it sets up a connection to your computer over wireless, and you need to set up an SSH server on your Linux machine, but that's quite easy to do, and it comes in the instructions as well on how to do that. And once you have that in place, it connects wirelessly, downloads your or uploads, I guess you could consider it, from GPotter any recent episode of a podcast that's recently been synchronized and downloaded by GPotter. So You don't even have to connect to your computer to get it on your device, as long as your device has wireless on it. And that little Android application was my attention was brought to it by Nightwise, who happens to be another podcaster, a technology podcaster, who uses Linux and Mac and Windows as well. He uses all three platforms and has a tech podcast at nightwise.com for those interested. And I'm sure he's on the G-Potter network as well. So thanks to Nightwise for that little piece of software that helps out.
Excellent. Okay, so there you have it. That's the skinny on listening to podcasts. All right, we're going to break for the your local and national news, and then we'll come back with another hour of Computer America. It's all about Linux tonight with Larry Bushy. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Computer America. Computers run the world, and we run computers. Call us toll-free, 866-606-TALK. That's 866-606-TALK. Or send us an email to live@computeramerica.com.
Hello and welcome into hour two of the nation's longest running and nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. This is the Computer America Show, and I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
And I'm your co-host, Ben.
And we continue on with our All Linux Show. It is the third Tuesday of the month, and traditionally on that third Tuesday of the month, we devote the entire topic to the subject of Linux, Linux, and more Linux. And here with us to help us along is Larry Bushy. He is our Going Linux Linux podcast. He is the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast. And Larry, welcome into hour two of the Computer America Show. And
thank you.
In the first hour, we talked about podcasting and but right now, I think we should look at some of the emails that we have. We have a number of them, and that you have selected, Larry. And so why don't we start going to them, okay?
Okay, sounds good with me.
This is from Richard in Brooklyn, New York.
Yes, and Richard is calling me out on a comment.
Okay.
Yeah, and he says, hi, Tom and Larry. Tom is my co-host. And, oh, by the way, I have another co-host as well.
Oh.
And his name is Bill.
Ah.
And he's on the East Coast. So now we have someone in the Eastern time zone, the Central time zone, and the Western time zone. So we've got it all covered.
That's nice. And, congratulations.
So, so continuing on with Richard's email, hey, Tom and Larry, I've been using Linux for a while now in a dual boot with Windows for several years, needing to use Windows for my work day and and then rebooting to Linux when the work day was done. I am currently using Mint on a Toshiba laptop, having switched from Ubuntu pre-Unity simply because Mint was a welcome relief from the real pain in the beep of trying to get everything to work on Ubuntu, at least on my machine.
See, that's our really sophisticated editing system here. When you try to say something, it goes beep. So.
Yes, exactly. Yes, and it uses my voice.
Yes, it's amazing. The technology is amazing. Yeah. Okay.
So continuing on, he writes. Anyway, I love your podcast, but I want to call you out in a friendly way on something I heard you say on the last Computer America episode. I think you, like most Linux podcasters, say pretty regularly that LibreOffice is a full-fledged replacement for Microsoft Word. For people who are doing simple work, this is true enough. But for people like myself, who for work use Microsoft Word to collaborate on documents with other people on an almost daily basis, using the full set of features like comments and track changes, LibreOffice simply doesn't cut it.
Yeah.
I wish it did. I certainly tried to make it work. Too buggy, not enough features. Mm. So not until I installed Word 2007 using Play on Linux, which was easy. I was able to begin booting into Linux for over 90% of my computing time. It has a few bugs in Wine, but nothing too bad. I am sure I am not the only one in this position. So as much as native apps are best, I think it would be only one more accurate It would not only be more accurate to temper a bit your language about LibreOffice and to mention more often the wine option. I also think that, ironically, helping people to use Microsoft Word on Linux will actually allow more people like myself to switch over completely. Oh. I can now consider doing away with my Windows partition completely, which I would never have been able to do if LibreOffice were the only option. I also know that a virtual machine is an option and have installed Windows 7 in VirtualBox, but my current machine doesn't seem to have enough RAM to do it well. I will try again with my next laptop, which is coming soon. Thanks, Richard. And he's in Brooklyn, New York.
Yay!
And Richard has a very valid point.
Yeah.
I am often too eager to say that LibreOffice is a complete replacement for the entire Microsoft Office suite. And it does replace the components like Word and Excel and Access and PowerPoint. But there are some features that LibreOffice has yet to catch up with Microsoft on, especially the more advanced features that are in the more recent versions of Microsoft Office. So I will be very careful about how I describe it in the future. And one of the things I wanted to explain as it relates to this email is the fact that Richard has described a couple of different ways that you can install a Microsoft product on the Linux platform. One is to use a virtual machine where you would need a licensed copy of Windows and
right.
install it in the virtual machine. And then, of course, you can get a licensed copy of Office and install it on that Windows in the virtual machine. And that will work just fine. Another is if you have a licensed copy of Office, you can use Wine, which is an emulation layer or an application layer on top of Linux that allows you to run some Windows programs. And
is Office one of them?
Yeah, Office 2007 is one of them.
Yeah, if they had to pick something, I would think if there was one, only one, it would be, you know, make it work, make Office work, because that's probably one of the most widely used programs in Windows today. I just have a quick question, because you're talking about this emulation and why not just, you know, if you have a legitimate copy of, you know, Office and you have a legitimate copy of Windows, which you would need to do the emulation, why not just do a dual boot? Because that way you don't have the additional layer that you have to, that slows things down. Just do a dual boot. You boot in Windows when you need Microsoft Office and go back to Linux when you don't.
Well, yeah, that's a good way to do it, and many people do it that way. There is an inconvenience that you have to reboot your computer, and other than that, it's a very viable option. On the other hand, you have to have both a licensed copy of Windows and a licensed copy of Word, which for the average computer user is not a problem.
Right, and again, every time you have to go through an emulation, it's one more task that the computer has to do, and it will slow down what it is that you're normally doing, as opposed to just running it natively, running Windows, you know, and let it do its thing.
Right.
I think, especially with something as complex as that. Ben, did you want to make a comment? I heard you say something.
Yeah, no, it seems like he wants to use Linux almost exclusively. So he was doing, like you're saying, dual boot, but he wants to just run Linux because you don't have to do like – you don't have to, like Larry said, you know, reboot your system every time. He said that he was able to get boot up in Linux 90% of the time after he installed Word 2007. So,
and you're quite right that when you're using an emulator, it will slow things down. Now, one of the things that's nice about Wine is it's not an emulator. It actually is an application layer that sits between the Windows program and the Linux program and acts like a translator.
That's nice.
Yeah, so it does have a little bit of overhead, but certainly not the level of overhead that a full-fledged emulator would have. So the Windows applications run quite quickly under Linux using Wine. So that's a really, really good option if you're using all of the fancy features of the word processor or the spreadsheet application that comes from Microsoft, and you have to be absolutely perfectly compatible with every font and every bullet point graphic,
right,
on a presentation. That's a great way to do it.
And there's also the hardware considerations too. If you want to send it to a printer, I mean, you know, you're going through the, you don't, if you're doing it directly through Windows, you know, there's no problem. If you're doing it through a translate. And you know what? I can sort of empathize with this when I run Windows on my Macintosh, because I use something called Parallels, which but Parallels does all that great stuff because it hooks Windows into all of my hardware, so I can do that. Or I can run dual boot and just run Windows, but I still need something, you know, to so it can communicate with my printer and all the other things. So it's a little more messy where with Linux and Windows, it's all, you know, based around PCs. Hey, we got to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. We're talking to Larry Bushy. It is our All Linux show. It is the third Tuesday of the month where we dedicate the entire topic to the subject of Linux. And right now we're in the middle of discussing an email from Richard, who listens to us in Brooklyn, New York. And I had another couple of comments. We're talking about running a Windows program such as Microsoft Office and using a dual boot, because when you tend to do things virtually, it slows down a little bit. Depending on what you mean by a little bit, sometimes it's a lot. It all depends how good the emulation is going. And I kind of likened it a little bit to what we do on a Mac, except that, you know, the things like Parallels will do it. And of course, there's you can also just do a dual boot. You can just use Bootcamp to boot into Windows directly. But it is the job of the emulator not only to simulate the operating system, but also to manage the computer's, how the computer communicates with anything that's attached to it, such as printers. And you need to make sure that when you go print in Windows and you're running Linux, that it's going to be smart enough to know, oh, I've got a you can't rely on the Windows driver. Well, you have to rely on the Windows driver, but you have to, the emulator has to be smart enough to know that it's diverting it to that particular printer that's hooked up to the computer at that time. So,
right, and certainly with a virtual machine, you have to worry about that. And that's another nice thing about Wine, is that because it's a layer that sits between the Windows application and Linux itself, when you hit print from Microsoft Word running in Wine, it sends it to whatever printer you've got hooked up under Linux. So it's sending it to the Linux operating system to print it. So you don't have to do any additional setup or anything else. You just install Word on Wine and away you go.
So therefore, if Wine is diverting it from Windows to Linux, therefore Linux is the operating system that's truly in charge when you have to configure it. But, and the only other difference that I can think between this and what you do on a Mac is that both Linux and Windows were designed to run on the PC that you're using, whereas Windows on the Mac really wasn't designed. Even though it's an Intel-based processor now, the hardware really wasn't designed from its inception to run, you know, the Windows operating system. The Bootcamp makes that possible, and everything. So you can't truly run it. Although you're close to native, it's really not. Like the computer from out of the box was designed to work with Windows, where the one that you're using with Linux is. And so that's the difference there.
Yeah. Exactly right. And, of course, you can also install Linux on a Mac as well. And I'm sure you have the same issues running Linux, which is designed to run on PC hardware, not Mac hardware, as you would trying to run Windows.
Sure. Yep.
And so I just wanted to make mention that you can install Linux on a Mac as well. And maybe one day we'll get you to do that.
Okay, maybe one day, right?
Maybe one day.
Because I'm so happy with OS X right now. I mean, it's such a rock solid operating system, does everything that I want, and you know, and so I'm just, you know, very pleased with it. But yeah, I know I can run Windows, and I do have Parallels, and from that there's one or two programs that is just not available for the Mac and never will be. I can boot into Windows and do what I need to do there, and then after it's done, I'm back to the Mac, you know. But you know, I'm sure it'd be fun to play around with Linux, and one of these days I probably will, you know.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, shall we go on to our next email?
Brian, yes.
Yeah, Brian has a very brief question asking what is the GNOME shell. He says, hi, Larry and Tom. The question I have is, what exactly is GNOME shell? Mm-hmm. Is it GNOME 3 or is it something else? Great show as always. Regards, Brian.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to have a longer answer than he has a question.
Okay? All right.
So let's back up a little bit and describe what GNOME is, or GNOME, and describe what his question really means, especially for people who haven't experienced Linux, and maybe this is the first time you've been hearing about Linux. So Linux is actually a text-based operating system. And what I mean by that is everything on Linux is a text file, or run by a text file. Your configurations for your network are text-based configuration files and so on. So you can actually build an entire Linux operating system from scratch using nothing but a text editor and the internet. So that gives you an idea that it is truly a text-based operating system. Now, to display graphics, Linux uses something called the X window system, or X windowing system, and that's kind of the first layer of graphics, and we're getting to what GNOME is in a second. So on top of that, to control the way that your windows look on, and I'm not talking about the Windows operating system, I'm talking about the window mm-hmm. that you're looking at on the screen,
mm-hmm.
to control the way those windows behave, you need something called a window manager. And mm-hmm. some examples of those might be things like IceWM, Fluxbox, Enlightenment, Kwin, Metacity, Compiz,
yeah.
All of those, we were talking about strange names earlier on.
Yeah.
Those are some strange names.
Yeah, they are.
But those are window managers. So they look at what the shape of the window is. Does it have a border? Is it resizable? Those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, now we're getting to something that addresses the question. On top of that, you need something called a desktop environment. And this is something that controls the entire desktop.
Yeah.
And examples there are GNOME, KDE, LXDE, XFCE, and something called Mate. So all of those are examples of desktops under Linux. Now, why are there so many of them under Linux when under Windows and Mac you just have what you have?
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the things with Linux is you have choices mm-hmm. of what you can run. And that makes it difficult to decide sometimes, but mm-hmm. for the most part, when you install Linux operating system from a distributor, it comes with one of these.
Yeah.
GNOME is one, and we'll answer his question after the break.
Okay. And you're listening to the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network. 866-606-TALK is the phone number if you have a question. 866-606-8255. Live at ComputerAmerica.com or our chat room at ComputerAmerica.com. We'll continue on with Brian's question. This is our All Linux Show with Larry Bushy. Stay with us.
Welcome back to the Computer America Show. Real quick, I just want to give a shout out for our Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
We are giving away free goodies. I think this week we're giving away a Magic Deck Plus.
Very nice.
To a lucky Facebook fan. So I just want to throw that there. Facebook.com/Computer America or the little logo on our homepage. And go there, like it, and you're entered to win prizes for ever. Yeah, I just want to throw that out there. Before the break, a very short question, has to be 15 words. And Larry, I think, was going into his 10th, 11th, 12th minute of answering. And but it's a good question. What exactly is GNOME Shell? Mm-hmm. So where you left off, sir?
Okay, and I'm not finished yet.
Yeah.
So
you weren't lying when you said that you have a much longer answer to a shorter question. Exactly.
Yes, exactly. So now that we've got the definitions out of the way, well, all but one, we can actually answer the question, what is GNOME Shell? So we've described the fact that there are several layers of things that make graphical things work on Linux. And the top layer that we've talked about so far is the desktop environment. And the example that Brian is asking about is GNOME, and GNOME is a desktop environment, and he talks about GNOME 3. It's just the third version of GNOME. And there's a layer on top of that called the GNOME shell. Mm-hmm. And what a shell is another little piece of software that interacts with that desktop environment and can actually take over some of the functions of the window manager as well. And it just gives you some of the graphical effects that result in things like wobbly windows or magic lamp effect minimize or things like that. So some examples of shells would be the GNOME shell or Unity or something called Cinnamon, which has recently been popularized by the Linux Mint distribution. Mm-hmm. And so the GNOME shell is a shell for GNOME, but there are others as well. So GNOME is the desktop environment. GNOME shell is something that gives you some fancy effects and some additional control over things, but you certainly don't have to run the GNOME shell if you're running the GNOME desktop. You can run Unity or Cinnamon or many others as well.
Got it. All right.
Okay, hopefully that made some sense.
Yes, it does. All right, so we're going to move on to Gregory's question then?
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
And Gregory asks, hey, Larry and Tom, I've been listening to your show since day one, even though I've used Linux most of my life. I just want to clarify something you mentioned on Computer America number 45.
Yeah,
another
right.
comment about our comments. Okay. You mentioned you didn't like how the Unity dock reveals itself when your mouse nears the left-hand side of the screen. But this can be changed in the Compiz Configuration Settings Manager, CCSM for short. By the way, Compiz is another desktop effects shell okay. that goes on top of GNOME. The very first option when opening the Unity plugin settings within CCSM is called Reveal Mode and lets you specify the area of the screen that will trigger the reveal action of the dock. Now, unfortunately, the top left option, it doesn't seem to work very well, but I'm happy with using the bottom left until it's fixed. You can also change the reveal time out if it triggers too soon for you. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the great podcast and keep up the good work, you two. Gregory from Canada, eh? Mm-hmm. Last name is pronounced Shire. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks, Gregory. Shire. And the Unity shell is something that was recently introduced by Canonical in the Ubuntu distribution of Linux. Mm-hmm. And many, it's come under a lot of criticism because Canonical has changed the entire user interface using Unity to do that. And this little dock pops out from the side, and unless you make some changes to its default settings, it comes out at the most inopportune times, it seems. So it looks like there's a way to change it. Thanks, Gregory, for bringing our attention to that. And I understand that there are some additional features since Gregory sent us that email that allow you to actually fix it in place so that if you want it out all the time, you can make that happen as well. So thanks, Gregory.
All right. Very good. By the way, Jack Death in the chat room says that he can't live without his Compiz. So
yeah.
This is one of the reasons he stays with Ubuntu 10.10. He says he also uses Cairo dock on the bottom. Now, what is that? Mm-hmm. That's an additional?
Yeah, that's a little dock. And if, for those familiar with the Mac, the little dock that you can have at the bottom, I don't know what you call it on the Mac.
The dock.
It is a dock, okay, mm-hmm. where your little icons can collect and they can bounce up and down when you launch them. Yep. Cairo dock has those same effects on Linux.
Interesting. Okay, there you go. Yeah, mm-hmm. that's part of the Mac OS itself. You can turn that on and turn it off, and you have a system's preferences on how you can – you know, you can control it. You know, you can put it on the left-hand side of the screen. You can make animate the dock. Jump up and down that, or turn that off. So there are a lot of things. But yeah, that's part of it. So now you can do something similar using Cairo dock if you're in Linux. Okay, very cool.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, there are a couple of different docks that you can use. Cairo's one of them. Docky's another. And if you're interested in a Linux distribution that looks almost identically to Mac OS X, you might try Macbuntu. Okay. Look it up on Google. It is convincingly, if you casually look at it, you would swear that it's OS X, and it's actually Ubuntu with a Mac skin on it. So it,
Macbuntu. Okay,
Macbuntu. Yes.
They even have the same Aurora effect as the wallpaper.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking at that right now. Yeah, exactly. Look at that.
And use the docky dock in the bottom there.
Yeah, I see that. That's very, very cool. They even do the genie effect. I'm looking at it right now, and then there's some of the other features that you find on the Mac. But this is very cool. All right, so more flexibility.
Yes, exactly. So that's just a testament to how flexible Linux is. You can make it look just like Windows 7 if you want, or just like the Mac. Or why would you want to do that? I mean, it's Linux. Come on, it's Linux. That's my attitude.
Yeah.
But if you really want to fool somebody, or if you just like the way it looks, you can do that. Or just go buy a Mac.
We here at Computer America have a lot of listeners in the UK, and I see that you also have someone, and his name's Dick. He wrote to you. What's up?
Yeah, he wrote from the UK. He says, "Hiya, Larry and Tom." That's a traditional English greeting. Hiya. Mm-hmm. I've been listening to your podcast for a few months now, and they have been awesome. Okay, I'm a few podcasts behind, and that sucks, but I'm slowly catching up. I was listening to podcast 152 about accessing your data on public computers. Most people have issues with you running your own OS on their PC. Mm-hmm. And if it's a large chain internet cafe, the PCs often use some form of ghost software to reset the PC back to a virgin state after it's been finished with.
Yeah, I've seen that. In fact, when you go to an Apple store, I ask, how do you let people play with them? He says, because basically we hit this reset and everything goes back the way we had it at the start. So no matter what they do, the ghost software just resets everything, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So Dick continues, one way I found very useful is to use Google to auth. That's TWOAUTH on my Android device. Mm-hmm. And he gives a link, and we'll include the link in the show notes. This means I can use my password on any public computer and not worry, as the second part of the password is time-encoded and only used once. Another very useful tool your listeners might like is OwnCloud, and that's at owncloud.org. If they have access to their own web host or server. Regards, and keep up the good work, Dick, in the UK. So I have taken a look at that Google authentication software for your Android, and it essentially gives you a little code, time-stamped code, that allows you to include that as a password. And I haven't tried it, but I'm assuming that it allows you to authenticate or put in your username and password and this little code, and it makes it safe somehow. You can read up on it using the link and try it if you like it.
Okay.
All right. So thanks, Dick.
Yeah, exactly. Now, when we come back, we're going to read this email from Daniel, who listens to you in Germany. As a matter of fact, I was just talking to someone in Germany. They have a big festival. Did you know that on Monday and Tuesday? It's called Carnival, and and it's like a carnival. And so evidently, when they have that, although it's not a national holiday, most people observe it. And then
wants to go to work when there's a carnival going on.
And then they have a Tuesday carnival. Get that. And then Wednesday, it's Ash Wednesday, so it's kind of a jumpy. I mean, you atone for your sins on what you did on Monday and Tuesday Carnival. Hey, we got to take a break, and then we'll continue on with Daniel's email. Stay with us. Larry Bushy is continuing on with us. We've got probably time for one or two more emails. This is from the next one is from Is it Daniel in Germany?
Yes, okay. That's the one.
Okay.
And as an introduction to this email, Daniel talks a little bit about Audible, and this is the audiobook publisher.
Uh-huh.
We have them as an advertiser for our podcast, they don't have a client that runs on Linux. And Daniel gives us a little comment about that because he's been listening to those ads as well. He says, "Hi guys, I haven't listened to your podcast for a while, but I just I wonder why he hasn't listened for a while. Anyway, yeah. I just remembered that you try to motivate people to work on a Linux client for Audible. And the way we do that on the podcast is just to mention that they don't have an Audible. They don't have a podcast, an Audible client for Linux. And if you're a Linux developer, maybe you'd like to help them out.
Yeah.
Anyway, Daniel continues. I wanted to let you know that Windows client installs perfectly under Wine.
Mm-hmm.
It connects to your account, and you can download the audiobooks. The only problem is that you can't transfer the audio files to your portable player because Wine does not yet support USB. Mm-hmm. I thought you might point that out in your announcement because helping the USB support in Wine would be a much bigger contribution to the community than an Audible Linux client.
Well, because, you know, USB is such a brand new interface, you know.
Oh, yeah. As an aside, I don't believe Audible actually wants a Linux client. If they did, they would already have one. And since they're working with iTunes, if I understand it correctly, you don't need Audible client if you use iTunes. It seems even less likely that they ever will. That was a long sentence. Or why do you think that there is no iTunes for Linux, even though Mac OS is based on BSD? Cheers, Daniel. P.S. I tried calling through the Google link, but it didn't work, maybe because I'm calling from Germany." And Daniel, that's exactly right. The Google voice line doesn't work internationally, unfortunately.
But Skype does. He could use Skype, couldn't he?
Skype does, yes. He could Skype us. That's
okay.
True.
All right. There you go.
But another point on Wine is that this USB thing, which is really the thing I wanted to talk about in response to Daniel's email. Wine doesn't work with USB. For a couple of reasons. First of all, the people who develop Wine also have a paid for version, which does support USB. So there's a little motivation there for them not to develop.
Oh wait, you want it to work with USB? Then you need the paid version.
Oh,
what? Oh, you want the car, but you want tires? Well, you need to buy. Yes, exactly. Okay. Okay.
So vendor lock-in is not strictly a Windows or a Macintosh thing. It happens under Linux as well.
There you go. All right. So that's the answer. He just has to get the little bit more.
I think one of the reasons why we don't mention we don't push too much that the Windows client for Audible works under Wine is just because of that limitation that he talks about there, which is most people want to listen to their audiobooks not on their computer but on some sort of portable device, and typically that portable device is USB interface.
It makes sense. Hey, listen, in the last minute or two, tell us a little bit about the Going Linux podcast and how they can get to it and what the topic's going to be. What's up next?
Okay. Well, what's up next is our listener feedback episode, where we do more of emails and voicemails and things like that. You can find us at goinglinux.com. You can email us at goinglinux@gmail.com. And how to subscribe to our podcast is at subscribe.goinglinux.com. There are instructions there, as well as a link to that video from Common Craft that I was talking about earlier on what is a podcast. You'll find all of that there on our website. Show notes, we have a forum, lots of places to get a hold of us. We have a phone number if you're interested in that. I can give it out.
Sure.
Okay. That's our Google Voice number, which is 904-468-7889. It goes straight to voicemail, but leave us one and we'll play it on the show.
And also, you can go to our links page at computeramerica.com, and we have a link right there to the Going Linux podcast on our links page. Yes, absolutely. Well, listen, Larry, hey, what can I say? Always a pleasure having you here on the show. And we look forward to seeing you again next time. It'll be on March the 20th. You'll be back again, and we'll have another fun topic about Linux. And thank you so much for being with us here tonight, Larry.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me on the show again.
We'll see you in March, okay?
Sounds great.
All right, bye-bye.
New music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.